Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives. Sharing their expertise and life stories. Making a difference one word at a time. Now, here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
Welcome, everyone. Welcome. Well, I'm bringing you a conversation today with Dr. Bill Sullivan. He wrote a book called Pleased to Meet Me, Genes, Germs, and the Curious Forces That Make Us Who We Are. It's published by National Geographic, and Dr. Bill Sullivan is a research scientist. And the book offers a new window into genetics, epigenetics, and microbes, how they all work with our environment to make us who we are. And Dr. Bill Sullivan says, we are not who we think we are. So there were so many fascinating stories in this book, and I think I used the word fascinating about 100 times during the course of our conversation, because we kept coming across things that just blew my mind when I was reading it. So let me just give him a brief introduction here. He is, as I said, a research scientist. He received his doctorate in cell and molecular biology, and he's an award-winning professor at the Indiana University School of Medicine. He studies genetics and infectious disease. He's published dozens of papers, dozens of articles. He's been interviewed on most of the major media outlets and publications. His book, again, is called Pleased to Meet Me, Genes, Germs, and the Curious Forces That Make Us Who We Are. And I want to tell you where you can find out more about him. The website is authorbillsullivan.com, authorbillsullivan.com. And here's my conversation with Dr. Bill Sullivan. We're talking about your book, Pleased to Meet Me. And this all began for you as a quest to see how much genes contribute to our behavior. And you write, you then had no choice but to write this book. So tell us why you wanted to write it.
It was based on observations. People do weird things, myself included. We all have our goofy quirks and dark sides, and I wanted to understand why some people overeat, why some people are violent, why some are so smart, and why some seem happy all the time. So I took a deep dive into the science behind these and many other behaviors and came up with a surprising revelation that our personality and actions are under the influence of hidden forces, genes, epigenetics, microbes, and our subconscious. And many of these things we have little to no control over.
I have to tell you, Bill, and this is being totally sincere here, this is one of the best books I've read in a long time. I found it totally fascinating. I couldn't put it down. I took it to the beach over the weekend, could not put it down till I'd finished it. And I think they should make it mandatory reading, quite honestly, in schools for everyone. I think life would be easier if we understood our biology to begin with. So kudos on that. You say, despite what we're told, I want to address this first of all, because we do a lot of shows with coaches, with inspirational speakers who say you can be whatever we want to be. You say, despite what we're told, we really can't be whatever we want to be. So explain that to us, please.
First of all, I just want to thank you so much for those kind words about the book. If you could see me, you could probably see that I'm blushing. those are just very flattering, and you really hit the nail on the head on exactly what I wanted to do with this book. I wanted it to basically be an understandable and enjoyable user's manual for our own bodies and our own behaviors. And my hope is that when people read the book, they have a much better understanding of why they do the things they do. Let's go back to your question then, which involves why we can't be everything we want to be. And that sounds pretty deterministic, but there is some truth to it. For example, I only come in at about 5'6", 5'7". I would love to be 6 feet tall. That's just not in the genetic cards for me, and it's a fact of life I'm going to have to live with. And we can extend this to a variety of behaviors that we encounter as well. The reason I may have the certain disposition that I do is a combination of my genes and my environment. over which, especially young in life, I had no control over.
When I've looked at things before, and I've talked with many psychologists, psychiatrists, etc., over the years, I've looked at behavior from a psychological aspect, but there's example after example after example in the book of how our DNA pretty much predetermines some of that, much of our behavior, actually.
Yes, it goes much further than even I anticipated, and I have a genetics background. I, of course, well respected the fact and accepted that genes are going to control things like eye color or whether you can curl your tongue or if you have a widow's peak, but I really didn't appreciate how deeply and far-reaching they can be in terms of predisposing us, predisposing being the key word, to certain behaviors. And then when you get that predisposition and you're put into the right environment, then that behavioral trait can emerge. So there's no question that there's a lot of variables and a lot of complexity, but there is also no question that our genes cannot be ignored when we talk about behavior.
Some fascinating stories in the book, especially around religion and politics, and very timely. I want to talk about that a little. But firstly, I want to look at epigenetics. And would you just explain to us the difference between genes and a gene that you say could have been scarred negatively and how epigenetics plays into that?
Sure, that's a great point. Epigenetics is very cutting-edge science, and that was one of the thrills about writing this book, because this is really hot new stuff right out of science laboratories. So epigenetics is helping break down the walls between nature and nurture, proving that they're not separate like many people have thought for decades. They're two sides of the same coin. Our genes and environment work together to make us who we are. Epigenetics is the study of how genes can be turned on or off or anywhere in between, like a dimmer switch, through chemical modification of the DNA itself, not the DNA sequence. And it can also involve chemical changes to the proteins that associate with DNA. That's where we get the word epigenetics. It's beyond the gene. So it involves the gene, but it's not a change in the sequence. So the environment affects how DNA is modified, which then impacts gene activation. The analogy I like to use, if DNA is the recipe of life, the environment is the chef.
Yes, that's a good way of putting it. Let's look at how our genes can be impacted. And one of the things you say, our DNA can actually be altered before we're even born, depending on our environment and what our mother's eating and even what our father's doing. So could you talk a little bit about that? You know, one of the things that you raised in the book was, can we reverse the effect on our genes of our mother's junk food diet? And you say, no, we can't. So could you explain how that works?
Well, the first disclaimer is I believe that study was done in flies. So we're working with a model organism, so there's going to be some caveats to interpreting those studies. But what you say, I think, is a pretty indisputable point, and science has backed us up now. There's epigenetic changes that take place in the sperm of DNA in men who eat junk food. So it's very, very common for the women to bear much of the responsibility for, you know, carrying the baby and making sure it's healthy. But what we've found through epigenetics is that, hey, dad, or dad-to-be, you got to shape up too, because your sperm is being adversely affected by this junk food diet or, you know, drug abuse or smoking. So that takes place epigenetically. Men are not changing the sequence of their genes per se, but they're changing how they're going to be turned on and off. And men who eat a junk food diet, to cite one example, may predispose their child to obesity and diabetes because of the way the genes are being tweaked. A similar thing happens in the fetus, in the mother, if she eats a lot of junk food during pregnancy. This is a concept that we call fetal programming. And just like you said, our DNA is already being programmed while we are still in the womb. And it's being programmed in a way that matches mom's environment. That makes evolutionary sense, but that also means that mom and dad have to be very careful of what they're doing just before and during the pregnancy.
That's an interesting point, because we often hear women, you know, they go on these hyper diets and take really good care of themselves, but I don't know any guys who've gone through that in preparation to do so.
No, they think they're shielded from this process.
Yeah.
That's entirely true.
So I want to talk about microbes, because I know this is one of your fascinations and what you study, and I want to talk about, and it sounds gross, but you'll explain this, what you call a germ cloud that we are all carrying around with us.
Sure, I'd be happy to talk about the germ cloud. I have all these visions of peanuts with people and all the around him. So it's not that visible, but dogs can certainly detect it. It's one of the main reasons they can distinguish us, because they have such a strong sense of smell. And there's studies that show that we can detect some elements of that as well. But what scientists have appreciated probably in the last decade or so is that the 3 pounds of bacteria present in our gut, which we call our microbiome, has an enormous impact on our well-being and behavior. And 3 pounds is a lot. That's about the same weight as your brain. So these bacteria affect everything from food cravings and appetite to mood and depression, just all sorts of things that we never dreamed possible. How did we find this out? Studies with germ-free mice. These are mice that are born under sterile conditions, so they don't have any gut microbes whatsoever, and that allows scientists to implant various bacterial species into their gut and then see what happens. One of the classic experiments is you take these germ-free mice and you give them intestinal bacteria from a lean person. The mouse will stay lean and healthy. If you give that mouse bacteria from an obese person, that mouse begins to overeat and gain a lot of weight. And these mice are genetically identical, so genes aren't even involved here. It's just the bacteria. So this is telling us a profound discovery that our bacteria can be one variable in the equation of our cravings and obesity.
And a question that always comes to mind when I see commercials on television for probiotics and eat this and it will balance your gut, I'm wondering if we can mess with it too much.
Well, you bring up a really good point. Whenever something new and exciting comes along, there's going to be a snake oil salesman at the ready to take advantage of people. There might be a little residue of truth in what they're saying, but it hasn't been backed up by rigorous clinical trials yet. None of this really has. This is all very avant-garde, very new science. So we should be taking it with a little bit of precaution. And you don't want to go screwing around with your microbiome in an adverse way, because frankly, we don't know how to change it just yet. There have been some studies that look encouraging with respect to depression, in that probiotics do seem to mitigate some effects of depression, but they certainly don't work as well as some of the antidepressants that doctors can prescribe. So, you know, you bring up a really good point, and another extension of that is this whole industry is not regulated at all. People can put whatever they want on the shelves and call it a probiotic, and the FDA does not require them to prove what's in it or whether it's effective. You honestly have no idea what's in that pill.
I do remember, you know, as a child, my grandmother, who was like born in 1890, she was really old when she had my mum, she would always say when we were children, if we were like mopey and not feeling great, she'd always say, these were her expression, you need a good clear out, your stomach's off. And so there's, I think there's a lot of truth in what she was saying, and now science is kind of catching up with some of those old wives' tales, if you were. There's a lot of truth in some of them, I think.
That is true. And if you look at a lot of, you know, the mental illnesses that are occurring, they are almost always associated with some sort of intestinal problem as well. So there is a really intimate connection between what's happening in our gut and what's happening in our brain. Scientists call this the gut-brain axis, and it is elaborated upon in the book.
And you do talk about serotonin and how, you know, we think of that as a brain hormone, chemical, whatever, and yet that resides in the gut too, correct?
That was one of the most remarkable findings. I had no idea that bacteria in the gut make 95% of our serotonin. And serotonin, for those who don't know, is a critical neurotransmitter that plays a big role in our mood. So if you have gut dysbiosis, which means, you know, a perturbation in the normal flora of the gut, that can profoundly affect the amount of serotonin your body has, which is going to affect your mood.
So while we're talking about serotonin, I want to just touch on dopamine quickly. You know, we have these reward systems in our body, and our brain is rewarded when we do something, dopamine is released. But there's also an anti-reward system, and I've not really heard much about that. Could you touch on that for us?
This relates to the fact that when the brain receives a dopamine hit, so dopamine is a neurotransmitter involved with motivation and reward at times, there are things we do in our lives that our brain wants to have positive reinforcement. So when we eat something really sweet, for example, our brain's going to get a dopamine hit because our body craves sugar. It's a valuable energy source, and our brain consumes about 20% of our calories just doing nothing. So it's a really energy-intensive organ. And dopamine helps regulate things that are good for it.
Excellent.
It's a way to calm back down, though, and that's where the anti-reward comes in. So that is a system. It's all checks and balances. If you have a flood of dopamine in the brain, that has to be cleaned up at one point, or else you can't receive another hit of dopamine. So it's like a seesaw. It has to come back down to baseline, and that's what the anti-reward system is about.
Yeah, quite fascinating. My guest is Dr. Bill Sullivan. His new book is called Pleased to Meet Me, Genes, Germs, and the Curious Forces That Make Us Who We Are. And we need to take a quick break. We will be right back with you. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair.
Radio is very competitive. Shows soar in popularity and then flame out. Sometimes, however, a real connection is made with an audience, and success blooms year after year. For over a decade, Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair has built a loyal following thanks to inspiring and stimulating conversation. Longevity, loyalty, exclusivity. Smart advertisers seek it out. With Vicky's valuable audience, the search is over. Discover the affordable, effective ways to advertise your business. Log on to ConversationsLive.net. That's ConversationsLive.net today.
And welcome back. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. My guest is Dr. Bill Sullivan. He's an award-winning professor at the Indiana University School of Medicine, and he studies genetics and infectious disease. His new book is called Pleased to Meet Me, Genes, Germs, and the Curious Forces That Make Us Who We Are. And this all came about, we said in the beginning, Bill, because you said that almost everything we think we know about ourselves, after you've done your research, we don't. We don't know anything about ourselves. So there's a lot to learn here. What did you learn about yourself?
Oh, I learned a lot about myself. And what kind of got the ball rolling was a seemingly trivial thing. In that I've, for as long as I can remember, I've always hated broccoli. And I've kind of been ostracized about this because here I am, a scientist, someone who spouts medical advice, and I hate a lot of vegetables. I can't stand them. They're too bitter for me. Of course, I know they're nutritious. I should be eating stuff like that, but I can't stomach it. So that's a personal element that got me involved. And I dug around and actually got myself genetically tested, and it turns out that I have a tiny variation in a gene that builds a taste bud receptor. My taste buds give the bitter chemicals in broccoli a bear hug, whereas most people, these bitter chemicals just float right on by. So I don't apologize for it anymore. My tongue is literally engineered to be highly sensitive to bitter flavors like those in broccoli. It's not my fault. Now that's and a little unsettling, right? Because it's unsettling because it suggests that our very likes and dislikes are not fully under our control.
Right. And I'm guessing a lot of people are going to use this as an excuse now. Oh, it's my genes, whether they know it is or not.
they have to be careful because, as the book illustrates, we are not predetermined genetically. That environment is an important component. But when you're talking about something like broccoli, there's not much I can do about that, you know, but I can eat other vegetables to compensate for that lack of nutrition.
So I want to look at, you had separate chapters on these, but I want to kind of look at taste, appetite, and addictions because they kind of go together. And there was a fascinating story in there about Ozzy Osbourne, who, by the way, is from my hometown, Birmingham, England. And there's a fascinating story there of how he was selected to have his genome sequences done. Because, all right, so, I mean, that man should have been dead a long time ago because of his addictions, right? Would you share some of that story with us?
I would love to. It's one of my favorite stories, and not just because I'm a fan of Black Sabbath and Ozzy Osbourne, but because I'm a fan of what the results showed. It's really remarkable. And Ozzy Osbourne did not elect to do this. He even said in one of his interviews that he didn't even know what a gene was. He thought, you know,
yeah,
the only gene he was familiar with was Gene Simmons, the guy in Kiss.
Right.
You actually hit the nail on the head. Scientists actively sought him out. in 2010 because they couldn't understand why he was still alive. With his notorious partying lifestyle, the multiple addictions that he had to a variety of drugs and alcohol, how could this guy still be alive? So they wanted to sequence his genome, and Ozzy was all for it. He thought it was fascinating. And back in 2010, that was not a trivial thing to do. That was very expensive at the time, and it was pretty labor-intensive. So it's quite an honor to be one of the first people to have your genome sequenced. But let's get to the results. That's where it gets interesting. They found genes in Ozzy Osbourne's DNA, variations of which that have never been seen before. And that might play into why he has this tendency to become addicted to a variety of substances and why he could tolerate so much alcohol. One of the variations, in fact, was in a liver enzyme called ADH4. It's an alcohol dehydrogenase. And I don't know if the science has followed up on this, but theoretically, that's an enzyme that would break down alcohol. And if he's expressing some kind of supercharged version of this enzyme, he may be able to process alcohol at rates that are far faster than most people. So maybe he can detoxify himself very quickly. That's just speculation, but I find it very intriguing that here we have a known alcoholic who has this variation in a liver enzyme that has to do with alcohol.
And then you've got the opposite. You've got people who have what you term alcohol flush reaction, where they get rapid heartbeat and a flush face with alcohol. That would be me, who really can't drink because it's not a particularly pleasant experience always.
That's correct. It's a perfect biological deterrent from becoming susceptible to alcoholism. Because you feel those effects of the toxic byproducts of alcohol very acutely, people who suffer that flush reaction tend to have very low rates of alcoholism because it's such an unpleasant experience. And we find this actually in quite a large percentage of the world.
And so under addictions, appetite, whatever you want to call it, we've got adrenaline rushes. We've got people who go seek adrenaline, go chase adrenaline. We had a guest on the other day who used that expression. And you say that recklessness tends to run in families. One of the examples you use is people who skydive. I've been skydiving, but I don't think I'm particularly reckless. But our genes have a play in that too. So talk to us about that.
Sure. This goes back to the dopamine, the neurotransmitter that drives our reward response. This is a complicated system, and there's a lot of different gears in the mix that are controlled by genes. There's one in particular that has been implicated in risk-taking and novelty-seeking, more adventurous people, and that's a gene called BRD4. This stands for a dopamine receptor, so it catches the dopamine molecule in the brain and kind of detects it. So some people are born with a little bit of this receptor, so they're very sensitive to dopamine, and they don't need a great thrill. But there's some people who have a variation in this receptor, and it doesn't catch dopamine very well. It takes a lot more dopamine to give them a thrill, so they have to engage in more high-risk activities or more exploratory activities. They seek out novelty because they need that in order to meet their, you know, the dopamine requirement in order to feel pleasure from that experience. Mm-hmm. So this was just as much of a surprise to me as it probably is to many readers that whether we're a daredevil or not has a genetic component, and I found that fascinating. Even more crazy than that, there may be a microbiome component. Mice, just like us, exhibit different personalities. Some are timid and some are adventurous. So if you take the intestinal bacteria from a brave mouse and put it into a shy mouse, that shy mouse will become more adventurous.
Oh, how interesting is that? Yeah, it's fascinating. I said at the start of our conversation, this is the most fascinating book I've read in a long, long time. Story after story that just was blowing my mind. We've just got a few minutes here, and I do want to touch on topics that I normally avoid, like the plague, religion and politics, because you write, we're all born atheists.
Let's do it.
We're all born atheists. There are over 4,000 religions around the world. So why do we readily adopt a religion, and why do we typically stay with the religion we were first introduced to?
Well, I don't think it's any surprise to a parent. Infants and babies are very receptive to what the parents do. You know, maybe they rebel a little bit, but like sponges, and they are absorbing things, and these things get like tattooed on their brain. They're almost like instinct behaviors after a certain window of time. So to be exposed to a religion, for example, in your most formative years is going to have perhaps long life-lasting implications, almost like language, okay? None of us really picked what language we want to speak the day we're born, right?
Right.
We just learn what our parents taught us.
Right.
And religion is very much the same way. You have very little choice in what religion, most people stick with the religion that they're born with. I say it's no different than the language you were assigned at birth.
So, and this is utterly fascinating, politics now. We're moving into politics, how groups become polarized, you know, groupthink. It's a very dangerous practice. You describe it as a loss for all groups. You say you can predict with 72% certainty which party participants support from a brain scan. That just blows my mind.
Mm-hmm. And it also kind of hints as to why it's so hard for one side to convince the other that they're correct. Because you're literally talking to people who have a brain that is wired differently than yours. So let's unpack that for a moment. Genes have something to do with this because they help build our brain structures. But what happens is that conservatives tend to have a larger amygdala, and this can be seen on a brain scan. The amygdala is the fear center of the brain. It's a highly emotional part of the brain. Now, liberals, in contrast, have a larger anterior cingulate cortex, which is an analytical part of the brain. So this makes conservatives very good at detecting threats, and liberals very good at evaluating threats. So in a perfect world, these two sides would be engaged in respectful dialogue to evaluate possible threats and proceed accordingly. But as you know, we're not talking to each other anymore because we're all trapped in our own little game, which has been amplified by social media and in some parts the press, and it is literally ripping us apart.
Yeah, that definitely explains why everybody thinks they're right and everybody else is wrong. You say sticks and stones can break my bones and bullying can actually break our DNA. So there are so many fascinating stories in here, but I want to give you an opportunity just to share a final thought with our listeners. What your biggest key takeaway was, what you'd like to leave them with.
The biggest takeaway for me is that we're not the people we think we are. Our behavior and the behavior of others is guided by these hidden forces that we've been discussing today. And knowing the biological basis of our actions is powerful knowledge that's going to put us in position to fix behavioral problems. And I outline some of this in the final chapter called Meet Your Future. So readers will have a better understanding of why they do the things they do and why other people do things they wouldn't dream of doing. I think it's going to help everyone learn to be more empathetic, patient, and understanding.
Well, we hope so. And the good news is that, I guess it's good news, that scientists are developing ways to edit genes, manipulate epigenetic markers. So hopefully that's going to be a cause for good. I can see it going either way, quite frankly.
Yeah, any fan of sci-fi has already seen people envisioning the apocalyptic scenarios. But hopefully we will be able to proceed responsibly.
Dr. Bill Sullivan, such a pleasure talking with you. Such a great book. Thanks for your time today.
Thank you, Vicki. It's a pleasure being on the show.
Radio is very competitive. Shows soar in popularity and then flame out. Sometimes, however, a real connection is made with an audience, and success blooms year after year. For over a decade, Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair has built a loyal following thanks to inspiring and stimulating conversation. Longevity, loyalty, exclusivity. Smart advertisers seek it out. With Vicki's valuable audience, the search is over. Discover the affordable, effective ways to advertise your business. Log on to conversationslive.net. That's conversationslive.net today.